Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm Victoria Thorpe, sitting in for Joseph Pache and David Onick. Our topic tonight is gene sequencing as a new weapon to prevent and treat cancer. A few months ago, actress Angelina Jolie surprised the world when she announced that she underwent an elective double mastectomy to prevent breast cancer. By having her genes tested, Jolie had learned that she is a carrier of a faulty gene that significantly increases her risk of developing breast and ovarian cancers. Her dramatic story shines a spotlight on the new ways that gene sequencing, or more broadly, personalized medicine, is transforming the approach to cancer prevention and treatment. According to the American Cancer Society, cancer causes almost 1 in 4 deaths in the United States and is the second most common cause of death after heart disease. While great strides have been made in treating cancer, this disease has long been a crafty foe for doctors and scientists. However, with gene sequencing, doctors now have a powerful new weapon in their arsenal. Tonight, we will hear from two Bay Area doctors who are leaders in the effort to use gene sequencing, and we will learn more about what it means for the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of cancers. How does gene sequencing work? Who has access to genetic testing, and how much does it cost? And how can you or someone you love benefit from this new research? Joining me tonight to discuss these questions and more are two Bay Area experts. Here in the KALW studio, we have Dr. Lincoln Nadald. Dr. Nadald helped develop technologies at Stanford University that identify DNA changes in cancer to predict whether or not a targeted cancer drug might be effective for a specific patient. He is the director of cancer genomics and personalized medicine for Intermountain Healthcare, a health network based in Utah. He's also on the faculty at Stanford University, where he specializes in gastrointestinal malignancies and cancer genomics. Welcome, Dr. Nadald.
Thank you.
And by phone, we're joined by Laura Vantveer. Dr. Vantveer is a world-renowned molecular biologist specializing in breast cancer. Her research focuses on personalized medicine and aims to advance patient management based on the knowledge of the genetic makeup of cancerous tumors, as well as the genetic makeup of patients. She currently holds a number of positions at UCSF as both a professor and lead scientist, and is a co-founder of Agendia, a private company that focuses on molecular profiling. Welcome, Dr. Vantveer.
Yes, good evening.
And welcome you, our listeners, to our show tonight. And beginning at about 20 minutes after the hour, we're going to start taking calls from our listeners at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Post a comment on KLW.org or on our Facebook page. Do you have cancer in your family and are wondering how to reduce your risks? Are you a cancer patient who is now wondering if gene sequencing can help you? We encourage you to start thinking of your questions for our guests now. So I'm going to start. I'm not a doctor, and probably most of our listeners out there are not doctors either. So I'd like to just lay out some of the groundwork here and get some of the terms out of the way and kind of explain to people what we're talking about. Let's start with the whole notion of gene sequencing and where that came from, what exactly does it mean, and then I'd love to also hear what this whole term of personalized medicine means. So I'm going to start with Dr. Nadald, and then Dr. Vantveer, I'll go to you in a second.
Well, gene sequencing is something that scientists have been able to do for years and decades even, but more recently it has begun to play a role in the clinical management of patients, and particular cancer patients. Gene sequencing refers to the ability to look at DNA at the very most basic level. So we're talking about taking DNA from a patient's tumor, for example, and being able to identify the very most basic changes or errors in that DNA and in the specific genes of a tumor that may have contributed to its development. So that's what we have in mind when we talk about gene sequencing.
And I know many people may have heard of the Human Genome Project. So maybe you could just talk about how this current treatment diagnostic element of using genetic information goes back to that effort, which I believe is about 10 years old now, or its conclusions about 10 years old.
Yeah, the mapping of the human genome was a really big deal that we heard about in the media, and it was completed over 10 years ago. And it cost several billion dollars, and it took several years to accomplish. And basically that effort was the first time that we were able to put into order all of the DNA from an individual's genome. And when we say genome, we're talking about one entire set of a person's DNA. So the Human Genome Project was the first time that we were able to, at the very most basic level, put in order all of the DNA from an individual. And so that DNA consists of what we call base pairs. And so that was the first time that we were able to put in order the several billion base pairs from an individual. That cost, as I mentioned, several billion dollars and took several years. That same effort now takes a few weeks and can cost thousands of dollars. So there have been really dramatic and breathtaking advances in genomes, in gene sequencing technologies that allow, that make feasible now this notion of genetic sequencing to help patients.
So it sounds like, so if I got that right, the genome got all the genes mapped out, and now when you talk about a faulty gene, that means that you can look at someone's, an individual's genetic makeup and see what's kind of off compared to that.
That's exactly right. That's correct. So we can compare the DNA from someone's tumor, for example, talking about cancer patients, and compare that to what we know that a normal genome should look like, and then we can pick out what the differences are and say, okay, we know that there are errors in this gene or that gene, and that this likely contributed to the development of that individual's cancer. And then when we talk about personalized medicine or personalized cancer medicine, that notion then is that we would take those errors that we have identified and line that up with drugs that we know can target the gene products of those errant genes. And so we're at the very earliest stages of this effort, this personalized cancer medicine effort. It's an exciting time. It's still a very early time, but it's becoming more feasible.
It's exciting. Dr. Van Fier, I'd like to bring you in now, and maybe you could help our listeners understand. Dr. Nadal mentioned the cost. So what does it cost to get your genes sequenced? Who pays for it? And how does all this work? Are we talking about people like Angelina Jolie, millionaires who can afford to, you know, ask these questions and figure out all the things that might go wrong with themselves? Or can normal people access this kind of testing?
That's a good question. So everyone can access gene testing. It depends a little bit what question one wants to have answered. So every cell in the body consists of some 25,000 genes, and a subset of genes is active in any given tissue in your body. And so genes are a good thing to begin with. However, some genes can have become faulty, and those are the ones we want to identify and can identify by gene sequencing. So in the case of Angelina Jolie, there was apparently in her family the knowledge that many women develop breast cancer over various generations and also at young age. So if there is such a familial question to understand whether a faulty gene that is inherited from generation to generation underlies the occurrence of breast cancer, then what one wants to do is sequence two genes, which are the BRCA1, the breast cancer 1, and the BRCA2, breast cancer 2 gene. So in that case, you're only interested in those two genes. Those tests have been offered commercially for the last 15 to 20 years and cost per gene about $3,000. And anyone who sees a doctor and a genetic counselor who has in a particular family more than average and at younger age and over different generations breast cancer in her family is eligible to do that kind of gene testing, which is also reimbursed by health insurance companies.
So if your doctor recommends that you get this testing, insurance generally covers it.
Yes. And so that's in particular when there is a familial risk for a particular cancer type. When we talk about gene sequencing more recently, people also talk about sequencing all genes or hundreds of genes in a person's tumor. So that's unrelated to inherited disease. It's just every person, or in particular in patients with metastatic disease. And as was just said, this is just starting, so it's only for some patients that this is being an option. One can sequence hundreds of genes and see whether particular genes are faulty to which there are drugs available. Some of those tests, for instance, in lung cancer, there is a small set of genes to which there are drugs available that are, those tests are like a few $100 per gene. Those are also reimbursed by health insurance companies. Those are tests that are in lung cancer or melanoma or colon cancer done for patients with primary disease or metastatic disease. If one is a little bit further in cancer treatment, and maybe some of those therapies still, there is after a while progression of disease, then a doctor and a patient may decide to do a more elaborate gene sequencing and look at many more genes than the few that are the initial ones to see whether there are faulty genes in those additional ones to which there might be drugs available.
Okay.
Those tests are not standard. That's cost like between $1,000 and a few thousand dollars per patient. Those tests are not yet standard reimbursed, but there is reimbursement on an individual basis that I know of.
Okay. So if I could just lay it out and put it back into my words, if I'm understanding this, there's sort of the genetic testing you do for screening, and that seems fairly straightforward to sort of see where you might be a carrier of a gene that's faulty. And then if you have cancer, there's a new research and new treatments that look at the genetic makeup of your actual cancer to see where there's interventions that you might be able to take. And then what you just described, Dr. Van Veritas, sounds like a third level where in a much more complex or in sort of specific cases, you might be able to delve into another level of information. And maybe this is where you get into this whole notion of personalized medicine. So this was where you're not looking at, you know, lung cancer patient A and lung cancer patient B at all the same, because they're going to look and you're a molecular biologist, but almost at a molecular level, what's different for each one of those patients? Is that getting anywhere close? And either one of you can.
Your description is very accurate. I think the term personalized medicine actually applies to all of those situations.
Okay.
I think it's only that with this sort of comprehensive analysis of gene sequencing in tumors, this new terminology came up. But actually, even if you would only test these breast cancer genes, BRCA1 and 2, to see whether for screening, that is also personalized medicine. And so that's now all brought together under one integrated effort in many cases.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and Dr. Van Veer highlights a really important point. There is gene sequencing for genes that are inherited from our parents, and that's to evaluate for risk of developing cancer. And that's what happened in Angelina Jolie's case, where there was a family history of breast cancer, and she found, with the help of her doctors, that in fact she carried a faulty copy of the BRCA1 gene. But that is different than gene sequencing for someone who already has a cancer and looking at that, at the DNA specifically in the tumor. And so there is this significant difference between gene sequencing someone's normal DNA looking for genes that confer a risk for developing cancer, and sequencing the genes from someone's tumor to look for errors or faulty genes that could be targeted with drugs. And those are very different scenarios.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a little bit more, and that's helpful to understand that we're really talking about two different well, I would say maybe gene sequencing for two different purposes, mm-hmm. although it sounds like the process, if I have that right, is the same.
That's right.
So, but I want to ask a little bit more about this BRCA1 and 2, and I guess it's also called BRCA1 and 2. Maybe we'll call it that just to easier to say. But because we've heard a lot about that because of Angelina Jolie's situation, but my understanding is that those two genes also point to ovarian cancer risk, not just breast cancer risk, and that ovarian cancer is actually has a higher fatality associated with it because it's harder to detect. And I don't know if Dr. Van Veer, I know that this is, you know, you're involved in this whole field, but or should we be hearing more about the ovarian part of it? Is a hysterectomy sometimes things people choose if they have a high risk of ovarian cancer? My understanding is Angelina Jolie's mother actually had ovarian cancer. I don't know if it was in addition to breast cancer or how all that played out. And I don't even know if that's... So I just would love to hear what you think about that.
So it's in particular the BRCA1 gene, where if one is a carrier of a faulty version of that, a woman has a risk of up to 70-80% to develop breast cancer during her lifetime, and has a 50-60% to develop ovarian cancer during her lifetime. And in most women who are carrier of such a faulty gene, to reduce their risk, actually a hysterectomy, or it's actually an oophorectomy, so that includes also the ovarian tissue, is actually done more frequently than a double mastectomy. And although double mastectomy, as we learned from Angelina Jolie, is done as well, in particularly an oophorectomy, removing the ovaries, has even a higher priority because the risk of ovarian cancer and screening for the occurrence of ovarian cancer is very, very difficult. Whereas for breast cancer, there are still screening options available, like mammography screening, ultrasound, or MRI. So in most women who are carrier of a faulty BRCA1 gene and they decide to remove their ovaries, that's of course also not a light decision to make, and not everybody will do that. And in most cases, and most patients who decide to do that, they do that once they have had their own children. But if they have children, then the number one reason to do these preventive surgeries is actually that they want to be alive for their own children, where they themselves have frequently lost their mother at a young age. If it was through the inheritance of their mother, they got this faulty BRCA1 gene, which can also actually come from your father.
And I want to ask about that in a minute, but I want to come back to this idea of women making this decision to prevent their own, you know, young death and having experienced that for their mothers. It's very powerful. Are we seeing enough? Is there enough people right now who have access to the test and to the surgery that you're starting to see and that you could see an impact on the rates of ovarian and breast cancer as a result of gene sequencing? Or are we too early to really measure that impact piece?
No, I think the testing for BRCA1 and 2 has been introduced as soon as the genes were identified that caused this risk, which was in 1994 and 1995. So gene testing in these families has been going on for almost 20 years now. And so there are, although in the first, say, up to 5 years, preventive surgeries were not so much immediately done. In my own experience, having led such a genetic counseling clinic when I was still working in Amsterdam in the Netherlands, after 5 years it became more and more common, and it also takes time for people to take the decisions. Not something you do overnight. So it has become more common, and as said, there has been done a lot of research around it. That the number one reason is for women, their own children.
And there's no way to intervene with that gene, right? I mean, I hate to ask sort of maybe what sounds like a scientific or science fiction question, but, you know, you're talking about intervening in a tumor, the DNA of a tumor, to try and address things. You can't intervene in your own if you get screened for this BRCA1 or 2. There's nothing you can do to turn off that genetic switch at this point in our understanding. I don't know. Dr. Nadal, did you have anything there?
Well, currently, there is not a way that we can prevent pharmacologically cancer from developing in that situation. There have been very nice clinical trials led by Dr. Jim Ford and Dr. Melinda Telly at Stanford evaluating the use of certain therapeutics in patients that already have breast cancer and are known to have a mutation in one of these genes, like BRCA1 or 2. And they have found that in some instances there are drugs that are now being developed that might be able to help patients that already have cancer. Those patients that don't have cancer but may carry this faulty gene, we don't currently intervene medically, aside from surgery.
Surgery is the only
exactly.
option.
That's right.
Okay. And what about the men? You know, men can be, I understand, a carrier for BRCA1 and 2, and they also can be at risk of male breast cancer. Do you do genetic counseling for men, too, your male patients?
Absolutely. Men are at risk as well, although their risk is lower than women. And men, you know, breast cancer in men is very uncommon. But in the presence of this gene, that risk goes up, and that's something that they can receive counseling for. And there are genetic counseling clinics available for that, both at UCSF and at Stanford.
So people can find out about them.
It's a good thing to realize that men have if they are a carrier in particular of the BRCA2 gene, have a risk for breast cancer, but their risk is much, much lower because also their breast tissue is, of course, much, much less.
Mm-hmm. I want to just take a minute to remind everyone that we're listening to City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KLW in San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. And tonight we're discussing how gene sequencing is changing our understanding of cancer with our guests. We have Dr. Lincoln Nadal, the Director of Cancer Genomics and Personalized Medicine for Intermountain Healthcare and a faculty member at Stanford University. And Dr. Laura Vantveer, a molecular biologist at University of California, San Francisco, who specializes in genomics as it pertains to breast cancer. We invite you now to call in with your questions or comments. Are you wondering how you can benefit from gene sequencing? Do you have a question for our guests? The number to call to join the conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on klw.org or on our Facebook page. I want to also ask about, we've heard a lot about BRCA1 and 2 and breast and ovarian cancer risk, but my understanding, we're doing some interesting screening work around other cancers. And Dr. Nadal, I know you are a specialist in gastrointestinal cancers, and I don't know if you've got some examples for us of how your this genetic sequencing is working in your area of expertise.
Yeah, this is I'm glad this came up. BRCA1 and 2, of course, are genes that we've been talking about and their role in both breast and ovarian cancers. And this same concept of inheriting a faulty gene applies to other cancer types. A good example of that is gastric cancer or stomach cancer, where we know that individuals can inherit a copy of a faulty gene called E-cadherin, or CDH1 is the other name for it. And this faulty gene, when inherited, confers an approximate 70% lifetime risk for developing cancer of the stomach. These individuals are also at risk for developing a slightly different form of breast cancer called lobular breast cancer. And we know that individuals that inherit this gene can prevent the gastric cancer or stomach cancer by having a gastrectomy procedure where their stomach is prophylactically removed surgically. This has really been pioneered in part by Jeff Norton, who is a surgical oncologist at Stanford, and Jim Ford, as I mentioned before, has played a role in that too. And it's important that we have now started to recognize that there are certain patients and families and individuals who inherit faulty genes, and that their risk for cancer is much higher than the average population, and that that can be prevented with the appropriate interventions.
So that, I mean, a double mastectomy sounds like a very dramatic decision, but I have to say having your stomach removed sounds even more dramatic in some ways. How do you function without a stomach? You know, is that and are you putting your, then are you putting your life expectancy at risk? I mean, what sort of happens to someone who's made that decision?
Yeah, so it does sound dramatic, that's true, but these patients do very well, and the surgical techniques have become excellent. And patients survive and do well and go on to lead normal lives. So, you know, they have prevented those who choose, who in whom these genes have been identified and who undergo this type of procedure. Many of them will have prevented a cancer from developing that could be deadly.
That's fascinating. Do you have a specific? Oh, sorry, Dr. Van Pier, go right ahead.
Maybe it's good to add a perspective that, carriership in either one of those genes is rare. And it's not that everybody should be concerned that they all of a sudden might be carrier of such faulty genes. I mean, the frequency varies between one in several hundred to maybe one in several thousand individuals. And people who are sort of by their... have these inherited faulty genes, usually know because in their family around them, a specific type of cancer occurs more frequently and at younger age than average. Just to take away the concern, that I would like to do that not everybody should be afraid that they are a carrier of such a gene.
Yes. Well, and in with the stomach cancer, is that something you routinely ask people about history of? And I'm thinking about those forms you fill out in the doctor's office. I mean, it seems, you know, this is where you can get into sort of a panicky feeling, like maybe everyone, you know, I think that's a great point, Dr. Van Tver, because do we all feel like we need to run in and get every gene tested? So at what point, you know, what triggers that for you as a doctor, Dr. Nadal? How do you know when to say, you know what, we need to get you checked for this?
Yeah, this is a great point, and Dr. Van Tver is absolutely correct that the prevalence of these faulty genes in the population is extremely low, and individuals can generally be aware of it just based on family history. That's one of the reasons that doctors will ask about family history, is to identify individuals or families in which certain cancer types are common in that family and happen at younger ages. But again, this is not something that the average listener should feel like they need to run out and contact their physician and get their gene sequenced, because it is a very low frequency. Nevertheless, it is also nice that we are starting to have modalities to approach these situations.
We have a call from a listener who has a question about testing, and I'd love to bring Maria on the line now.
Hello.
Maria, thank you for calling City Visions Radio.
Thank you for taking my question. My sister-in-law and her mother have died from breast cancer in the latter 4 years, and also her brother has it right now. My question is, my sister-in-law, they have a daughter, she's 20 years of age, and two sons in their 20s also. At what age would your guests consider that they should look into this sort of thing?
It's an excellent question. Dr. Bantvier, I'm going to start with you.
Yes, very good question. Thank you very much. The testing for faulty genes for breast cancer is actually never done in individuals before age 18 or 21. And it starts to gradually increase if a person is ready for it to be done when women are in their 20s. And the reason is that the risk for breast cancer, if one is a carrier of such a faulty gene, start to increase as of age 25 or 30. So there is sort of a reason to start testing some 5 years before that risk slowly starts to increase. So usually testing is done women in their 20s or 30s.
So would a young woman of 20 be too young for a test, Dr. Van Fier?
Sometimes it's actually also dependent whether in a particular, there are actually also differences between families. So in some families, the risk or the occurrence of breast cancer is really at young age. In some other families, it's a little later. So sometimes it depends on that. 20 is very young. 25 is more a reasonable age. 25.
Maria, does that feel like a good guide for you to talk to your niece about?
Thank you. And the other question I had in relation to the age as well, does it make a difference? For example, her mother had received her cancer first at 70, and her daughter was first diagnosed in her 40s. And the mother's went into remission but then came back when she was 90. Mm-hmm. So does it have any difference if the parents of the child, you know, have had the cancer come at any age? Does that make any difference at all?
Yes. Another excellent question. So when there is a faulty inherited BRCA1 or 2 gene, then the cancer occurs usually at a young age. So a breast cancer that is diagnosed at age 70, or even if there are multiple female family members that have breast cancer in their 60s and 70s, then the likelihood that it's actually inherited due to a faulty BRCA1 gene is very, very low. But as soon as one of the family members is diagnosed before age 40 or before age 50, then that is a reason to actually to seek genetic counseling. It might still be, and so that it's being discussed, what is the likelihood that in a particular family this is really inherited, which would then be a reason to propose to do the gene testing. But it could well be that if it's all at older age, that is not of a concern.
Okay.
That's great. Thank you for those helpful answers. Thanks for your call, Maria. I wanted just to remind everyone that we're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing how gene sequencing is changing our understanding of cancer with our guests. We have Dr. Lincoln Nadald, Director of Cancer Genomics and Personalized Medicine for Intermountain Healthcare and a faculty member at Stanford University, and Dr. Laura Van Fier, a molecular biologist at UCSF who specializes in genomics as it pertains to breast cancer. We'd love to hear from you, our listeners, with your questions or comments. Are you wondering how you can benefit from gene sequencing? Do you have a question for our guests about cancer risk or prevention? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on KLW or on our Facebook page. I wanted to ask, this is a little bit of a global question around this prevention question. It seems that and Dr. Van Fier, you did such a nice job there kind of teasing out the many nuances, it seems like, in the questions of whether somebody's at risk or not. But I'm just curious, we'll start with you, Dr. Nadal. Have you had your gene sequenced? I mean, is this something, and I know we just talked about not, you know, having people rush into doing this, but it seems like a perfect example of like a little information is a dangerous thing. And I'm just wondering, you know, does this feel like for you as a, you know, just not to put you on the spot, but I'm curious about whether you've had it done, and if so, the information that came back, how it felt to you, and, you know, the questions that came up that then became very challenging to look at all that information.
I have not had it done, and I wouldn't have it done unless there were a significant history in my family that met certain criteria. That would indicate screening would be important or helpful or would somehow change the management of my situation. That being said, I have had patients where the genes in their tumors have been sequenced, and that has led to some important insights. We know, for example, in colon cancer, that the presence of a mutation or a faulty gene can lead to responding differently to certain drugs, certain chemotherapies. And so we have used that to identify which patients we think would respond well to some treatments and which patients would not respond as well to some treatments. So we're using, you know, gene sequencing not only preventatively, as we've been discussing in cases like breast cancer and ovarian cancer and stomach cancer, but we're also using it now. It's in its infancy right now, but we're starting to use it in patients who have cancer to determine who might respond to which drugs. And so in those cases, I have used it, and it can be quite helpful.
And not to keep coming back to this point, but I'm just curious about this. When you get your gene sequence, say you are at risk for stomach cancer or breast cancer and your doctor recommends, do you get other information back? Like all of a sudden you find out you might be at risk of Alzheimer's or something that really isn't preventative at this stage of our understanding? Or, you know, are you then faced with a barrage of information that's difficult to process beyond what you were originally looking to find out?
Yeah, that's a really hot topic right now. And it's something that we're just grappling with. And it's because when you sequence, in the case of inherited breast cancer or ovarian cancer, we're really just sequencing one or two genes. So we don't get other information back. We don't get information about a patient's risk for other unrelated diseases or disorders.
It's very targeted.
It's very targeted. That's right. There are some cases where individuals can run out and get their genes sequenced commercially without really an indication, and that can be problematic because then there is information revealed about their risk, and we're not sure how to handle that or understand that. So gene sequencing right now is really most appropriate when there is a specific question that needs to be answered, because otherwise we start to run into these problems of what do we do with this information that we've discovered? How do we handle that? And it's just too early to have the answers to those types of questions.
Do you have patients come to you who, the one I've heard of is 23andMe. It's a commercially available genetic testing process. I don't know that much about it. But have you had patients come to you and say, oh, I did this test and now, you know, look at the chart I got back and what do I do about it?
Yeah, well, that does happen. And it's hard to know how to handle that because the data is still immature in that regard, and we don't know enough to say, you know, an alteration here in this gene or that gene is going to absolutely lead to, you know, diabetes or Alzheimer's or whatever the concern may be. So some people have chosen to do that. There are commercially available tests for that. You know, as a physician, I wouldn't advocate that to a patient because we just are not sure what to do with that kind of information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it feels would seem potentially quite scary to receive all that information.
Yeah, and there's a lot of misinformation out there as well. And if someone is not equipped to handle the kind of information that can come from that type of test, then yes, there can be a lot of uncertainty and fear. And so those are the problems that can be associated with it.
And Dr. Van Veer, I know you have developed you have a company actually that does a form of genetic counseling and testing. I don't know if you want to share a little bit about MamaPrint and how that works.
Yes, I can do that. I think we don't really call that genetic counseling. I think the terminology genetic counseling is for those germline tests that are used in screening.
Oh, sorry. I apologize. You define it for us since I don't know.
So the other type of gene testing, including gene sequencing, is done in diagnostics. So, and I think that's also the exciting part of gene sequencing that's currently ongoing, that we more and more learn how to use our scientific knowledge of the biology of the disease itself towards patient management. And so one of the things I've been involved in and developed ultimately in a patient robust test is a gene activity signature, a gene prognosis signature that in breast cancer foretells whether a woman has a high risk or a low risk of a recurrence. Mm. And so a pattern of the activity of genes in one's breast cancer can show whether it's a very aggressive cancer or whether it's a very slow-growing cancer, where there is a very low risk of recurrence. And the way how that test, MammaPrint, is utilized in clinical practice is that information on the gene activity is utilized to determine who would benefit from chemotherapy and who is in need of chemotherapy. So there are two commercial tests available. One is the one I've involved in, MammaPrint, marketed by company Agendia, and the other one is an originally Bay Area developed test, Oncotype, commercialized by the company Genomic Health.
Well, that seems very important for someone who's facing difficult treatment decisions around cancer. So
it really helps in those treatment decisions to understand who needs, beyond surgery and local treatment, further what we call systemic treatment. So the first step is to know who is in need and who would benefit. Then the next step is actually what also comes from all this gene sequencing, then to understand what would be the best treatment to use. And that's when these targeted drugs that Dr. Nadold already talked about, if you have a particular gene mutation, you have the possibility to give a very targeted drug to treat that cancer because it has this specific alteration.
Okay, that's great. I wanted to go to a caller next. We have Mary from San Francisco. Mary, thank you for calling City Visions Radio.
Hi. I have to say I'm taking issue with a whole lot of the discussion of gene testing, especially around genetic information and disease, especially for women, because a lot of it seems to say that if you have a particular gene, you are going to get this particular type of cancer. And it's my understanding that there's an awful lot of different things, including the epigenome known, that come to affect whether or not you'll get cancer, and it's not by any way prescriptive. In my experience, I've had doctors say things like, if you came in with an ovarian cyst, I would not let you leave my room until you agreed to have a complete hysterectomy with removal of ovaries because I don't want you to get cancer. And I think there's a whole lot of fear-mongering around these illnesses that has nothing to do with the reality that things like ovarian cancer are really, really rare diseases.
I think that's a great question. I think, Dr. Van Fier, because this is more of your specialty, I'm going to go to you first, and Dr. Nadold, if you've got something to add, we'd love to hear from you, too.
I think there are, of course, many different situations in which individuals, women or men, whether there might be reasons to investigate whether a certain situation requires follow-up action, either by a treatment or by genetic testing in some cases, or by surgery. And I think that, of course, really depends on the individual situation, which is hard to evaluate. But indeed, if there is a reason for that there is something that should be further investigated, I think that's, of course, always a good thing. I don't think that in every situation gene testing will be the solution. It could be more diagnostic procedures or sometimes wait and see. So it's hard for me to sort of respond to your example. But I think gene testing can be part of it, but certainly not always.
Dr. Nadold, what do you think about this this sort of sense that we're in a bit of a hysteria about all of this that might not be warranted with the actual risks that are out there?
Yeah, I think the caller brings up a good point about absolutism. So what we're evaluating in most of these cases, particularly when we're talking about BRCA1 and 2, is risk. And so what is an individual's risk of developing cancer over a lifetime? And we know from large population studies of individuals that carry these faulty genes that there is a significantly increased risk. And so those patients should have counseling and be informed of all of the risks and then be able to make a very personal decision with all of the appropriate information in hand.
Right, but I think that I didn't mean to interrupt, but I think that part of my issue is with the way risk is described. because often lifetime risk is confused with individual risk, and the idea that someone's at 87% risk, I'm not sure that people understand what that means, or an increased risk. I mean, for very rare cancers, you know, so you get a 10% increase in something that affects 20,000 people, that's 200 people. That's very different from, you know, another 20,000 people getting a disease.
I think, indeed, that's a really good point. I think the 87% risk that was mentioned in the case of Angelina Jolie, if that actually was wondering myself how they could get to this exact estimate.
Not 86, it was
possible.
87, right?
It's usually a range. And I fully agree with you that actually the communication about risk is really difficult, and that there are some tools in decision support available nowadays that can help women, in this case with such a gene, if you are the carrier of such a faulty gene, understand what it means, a 50% increased risk by age 70, for instance, or a lifetime risk of 80%. Those are hard to understand, although, I mean, if it's really at that high percentage, that is more easily to understand than when we're talking about 20 or 30%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it sounds like these are very complex questions that would be done in a one-on-one conversation with your doctor. But Mary, I really appreciate the call, and I think those were excellent questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to just take a minute and remind everyone that we're listening to City Visions on local public radio in San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing how gene sequencing is changing our understanding of cancer with Dr. Lincoln Nadald, Director of Cancer Genomics and Personalized Medicine at Intermountain Healthcare and a faculty member at Stanford University, and Laura Vanterveer, a molecular biologist at UCSF who specializes in genomics as it pertains to breast cancer. And we'd love to hear from you with your questions or comments. You can call us at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on klw.org or our Facebook page. I wanted to go to a quick... we have actually a couple callers on the line, and we've got Ed from Menlo Park. Ed, do you have a question for City Visions?
Yes, I do. My father developed stomach cancer, but unfortunately... By the time they did his gastrectomy, it had metastasized to his esophagus, and he died of esophageal cancer a couple of years later. And I'm just a few years shy when he was diagnosed with at the age that he was diagnosed with stomach cancer. And now no one has ever suggested that I be screened genetically. I've had every 8 to 10 years, I get an endoscopy, and I'm on these proton pump inhibitors because of GERD that I presently have. I just wondered what recommendations your guests would have.
Dr. Nadald?
Yeah, and how old was your father at the time that he was diagnosed?
I remember it was shortly after retirement, but he was a stubborn man. He wouldn't go see doctors. He'd been in pain for quite some time, and he was taking tons of antacids and trying to control his discomfort, and he developed kidney stones, as a matter of fact, from that. And so I don't know when it actually started. But he did have an ulcer when he was 25, and I don't know if that's a contributing factor or not, that he had surgery for an ulcer when he was age 25.
Well, the risk for developing something like gastric cancer is higher in individuals where there's a prevalent family history. And so when one individual in a family has been diagnosed, that results in a slightly increased risk to other first-degree relatives. But it would not necessarily make us think that their children would necessarily be carriers of a gene that would confer a lifetime risk, particularly if the affected individual had been diagnosed at an older age. That was more likely was just an example of a cancer developing. Sometimes that can happen with gastroesophageal reflux disease, as you mentioned, or GERD. And so there wouldn't necessarily be an indication for someone to go have gene sequencing for to determine their risk of gastric cancer if there weren't additional family members also affected.
My sister, who's 12 years younger than I am, has just begun experiencing a great deal of stomach pain over the last few months, and she's going to get some attention. I just don't know if the fact that she and I both have issues is an indication of anything. But what do you think?
It wouldn't necessarily indicate that anyone in the family carries a gene, a faulty gene in this case. That being said, it would be very important to follow up all of these symptoms, of course, with your doctor to evaluate the risk of complications from that, for sure. But, you know, the kind of history that we're just talking about in a family wouldn't necessarily mean that those individuals needed to get screened to determine whether they're carrying a faulty gene. You know, in general, this gets back to that principle that we discussed before, where the overall prevalence of these faulty genes in the population is very low. You know, the prevalence of the BRCA genes is around 2%, and the gene and lower in some populations, some subpopulations and ethnic groups. And the prevalence of a gene like CDH1, which confers risk for gastric cancer, is much lower than that. So we're talking about screening for these genes, but it's in a very select population, and those individuals with a very clear family history. And by and large, the population is not really at risk for carrying these faulty genes.
Thank you so much, Ed, for your call. I think that's a really important point to really get to some of the numbers about this. We really aren't talking about majorities of people or even, you know, small, you know, even a, you know, lower. It's a very small number of people that really are in a situation where the genetic screening is going to make that big difference in their treatment path and their understanding of what their risk for sounds like premature fatality from some of these diseases is. We have another call. We've got Judith from San Francisco. Thank you for calling City Visions Radio.
Hi. Thanks for being there for this show. My question is regarding my niece, my sister. Her mother was diagnosed at the age of 44 with inflammatory breast cancer and actually had a bone marrow transplant and lived for 11 years, which made her a statistic. She had many other cancers in that 11 years. Her daughter was tested positive for BRCA1 when she was in her late 20s. She's now in her mid-30s. She's had two children. I'm just curious how you would advise someone in that position in terms of prophylactic surgeries at this point in her still young life, but with a very hard story of her mother.
It's a great question. Dr. Van Fier, I think that's a good one for you to start with.
Yes, I think, well, thank you very much for sharing the information, and I can see how difficult decisions are for people in their life and when to start thinking about next steps or not. I think the best she can do is actually to talk to a genetic counselor at one of the centers where a genetic counselor is being available, because there's so many aspects of all these decisions, and people can be helped to oversee what the consequences are and what maybe the needs are and what they need to think about. So I think my advice would be that indeed if she had children and is in her mid to late 30s, that might be, and I think I assume that when she had the genes tested, she was also had been counseled by genetic counselors. Maybe it's time to go back and to sort of pick up where she left it and discuss if there's what would be available and what she would like to do or not.
Okay. We're running out of time, so I'm going to leave it there. I really appreciate your question, and thank you so much for calling City of Visions. I think we have time for one more question. We have a question from Ruth Ann.
Oh, hi there. I was wondering, could ask either of the guests, if I had a sister who died of colon cancer and my dad died of pancreatic cancer, are there just general cancer genes, or is it organ specific?
Okay. I'm going to ask Dr. Nadal to just jump in super fast. I know, and I just want to caution everyone that obviously no one's giving medical advice here, but if you want to just give any very fast advice for this caller.
Well, generally, the genes that we've been talking about confer the highest risk in certain organs. So, for example, CDH1 faulty genes confer the highest risk in the stomach. BRCA1 and 2 confer risk for cancer in the breast and ovary. There are familial syndromes where cancer can, faulty cancer genes can be inherited, and that would result in colon cancer. There are very rare cases of inherited pancreas cancer, we believe. So those are possibilities. To say that a colon cancer and a pancreas cancer in the same family necessarily indicates that there is a gene would require, you know, additional, it would be a whole separate long conversation.
Okay.
Maybe a short thing to add is that in all of those situations, age at diagnosis is an important discriminator, being young age as an indication for inheritance.
Yes. That's an important point.
And we've heard that several times tonight, and that's one I don't think I, as a lay person, really understood before this show, so I feel very educated about that. We're going to have to close. Dr. Nadal and Dr. Van Veer, I don't know if you could sum up anything super fast. You want to, any closing thoughts for us in sort of 30 seconds or less?
Maybe one thing to add, and I think that's particular for diseases like breast cancer and prostate cancer, but in particular breast cancer, a lot of women are, of course, being screened. And I think it's important, and one of the programs we've implemented at UCSF, and I think there are similar things at Stanford, is to ask questions to women who are being screened whether there's any familial component of breast cancer in their family, so that we really can identify those individuals who might benefit from the knowledge of inherited faulty genes.
And it sounds like it's something to bring up with your doctor if you've got history in your family. Okay, Dr. Nadal, anything there you want to add?
We spent a lot of time discussing the really important points regarding inherited cancer genes and familial cancer syndromes. And we're going to hear more about gene sequencing in sporadic cancers or cancers that are not necessarily present in families, but just occur without any apparent reason. And we're going to be able to use more of this gene sequencing in the future to guide management of those patients. And that will be exciting.
That's great. Well, this has been a really interesting conversation. I want to say thank you so much to Dr. Van Veer of UCSF and Dr. Nayald of the Intermountain Health Clinic at Stanford University for being our guest tonight. And thank you, all of our listeners who were joined us tonight. We had excellent questions. For a link to this and other City Vision show, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and subscribe to alerts and podcasts, visit the City Visions page on klw.org. Our engineer tonight was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Great job, Wendy. Please join our regular host, Joseph Pache, next Monday for another show in our series, Government from the Inside, as he talks to San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon. This is guest host Victoria Thorpe. Thank you for listening and have a great week.